Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Con Hallinan, an analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, who takes a critical look at the Obama administration's developing strategy toward the conflicts in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Carissa Cunningham with the group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, who assesses the recent wave of victories for gay marriage around the U.S. and the challenges that still lie ahead. And Dr. Margaret Flowers, who talks about why she and seven other single-payer health care advocates were arrested at a Senate roundtable on health care reform on May 5th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Zimbabwe's fragile coalition government appears more unstable as a judge revoked the bail of 18 human rights activists who were accused of plotting to topple President Robert Mugabe. Harare magistrate Catherine Chimanda withdrew bail after formal charges were filed against the activists, including Justina Mukoko, head of the Zimbabwe Peace Project, who documented human rights abuses related to the controversial 2006 presidential election. The activists were first arrested in December and held for 3 months before they were released on bail. The defendants deny charges that they tried to overthrow Mugabe and are allied with the opposition party Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC. Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai blasted the detention of the activists, saying it undermined the coalition government between the MDC and Mugabe's ZANU-PF party and flagrantly disregarded agreements made in the power-sharing deal. Western donor nations have withheld any aid to Zimbabwe until all political prisoners have been released. Zimbabwe is currently seeking $8.5 billion in emergency relief. Nepal fell into political crisis in early May as Prime Minister Puspa Kamal Dahal, a former Maoist rebel, resigned. Dahal stepped down from the cabinet after President Ram Baram Yadav, leader of the opposition Nepali Congress Party, who was also commander-in-chief of the military, refused to fire Army Chief General Mukmangud Katawal. The general has refused to integrate 19,000 former Maoist fighters into the army. The former guerrilla force has been confined to camps under a 2006 peace accord. In his resignation speech, Dahal declared, "The unconstitutional and undemocratic move by the president has pushed our country into political crisis. The president has no power to act alone without the prior approval of the cabinet." A week after the prime minister resigned, riot police broke up a crowd of 400 Maoist protesters trying to march on the president's office. Efforts to create a new government have stalled. Several Maoist coalition partners, including the Communist Party of Nepal, United Marxist-Leninist, withdrew from the government after the prime minister attempted to oust General Katawal. Talks are still underway to form a new government in Nepal. The big banks, recipients of billions of dollars in government bailout money, actually helped fuel the subprime mortgage bubble that led to the collapse of the financial and banking industries. An analysis by the Center for Public Integrity of 7 million subprime loans found that 21 of the top 25 subprime lenders were financed by big banks. Moreover, several of the banking giants, like Citigroup and Wells Fargo, had their own subprime operations. Today, nearly all top subprime lenders, such as Countrywide Financial, have closed, gone bankrupt, or been taken over by other banks to avoid being seized by the government. In the peak year from 2005 to 2006, the now-defunct Lehman Brothers was the top underwriter of subprime-backed securities, followed by Royal Bank of Scotland, Greenwich Capital, and Countrywide Securities. In 1994, the average homeowner took out a mortgage that amounted to 165% of yearly income. By 2005, the typical mortgage had risen to nearly 250% of annual income. When the housing bubble burst, it threw millions of homes into foreclosure, triggering the financial crisis. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As the Taliban intensify their insurgency and the civilian death toll rises in Afghanistan, the Obama administration has moved to replace the U.S. and NATO top military commander there. General David McKiernan, named Afghanistan NATO commander 11 months ago, will be replaced by Army Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, who had previously commanded Special Operation Forces in Iraq. U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan's western Farah province on May 4th resulted in an estimated 125 to 167 civilian deaths. Afghan President Hamid Karzai responded to the air raid, still under investigation, by demanding a halt to all U.S. bombing runs. According to the United Nations, U.S. and Afghan government forces have killed more than 800 civilians last year, an increase of a third from the previous year. Insurgents who have launched dozens of suicide bombing attacks are reported to have killed twice as many civilians. Not long after taking office, President Obama made good on his campaign pledge to escalate the Afghan war by ordering the deployment of 21,000 additional American troops by the end of the year, bringing the total in-country to 68,000. Mr. Obama views the Taliban's increased control of territory in neighboring Pakistan as extremely dangerous and linked to the Afghan war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Khan Hallinan, an analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus, who examines the Obama administration's developing strategy toward the conflicts in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Putting Crystal in there suggests that they're going to have a strong emphasis on counterinsurgency. And that will mostly concentrate in Helmand province. There are 21,000 U.S. troops going, of which 17,000 will be combat troops. And almost all of those are going to go into Helmand province in the south. And if the stress is going to be on counterinsurgency, then what we're going to see is we're going to see a very steep rise in the number of civilian casualties, because there's a sort of one-to-one relationship between these special forces and civilian casualties, because they take these special forces and they put them out there into the villages and they get themselves in a firefight and then they call in airstrikes. And we have dropped 14,000 tons of bombs on Afghanistan since 2004, and we've increased the tonnage, the bombing tonnage, 1,100% since 2004 as well. So this is disturbing. I was hoping that what they were going to do was to put those 17,000 troops in there and just tell them sit tight. The current situation in Helmand province, which is arguably the most dangerous in Afghanistan, is a direct relationship to the surge back in 2005. 2005, it was quiet. They put this surge in there and just all hell broke loose.
Where do you think things are going in terms of the overall strategy? This is certainly in many ways more complex, as you have Pakistan with a nuclear capability, the Taliban movement that seems to be making inroads into Pakistan, a very unstable government there, and gains by the Taliban on the ground in Afghanistan.
Since 2005, they controlled about 52% of the ground area, and they now control about 72%. So they certainly have made gains. I think that, you know, the problem is that we've talked about this, you know, the Taliban in Pakistan, they're the bad guys. And I think what we're doing is we're kind of looking through it, the prism is much too narrow. The Taliban, for instance, in Afghanistan is a lot more complex than it was back in 2001 at the time of the invasion. It split into several wings. One wing it went to Pakistan and is located in Baluchistan now, right outside of the city of Quetta. Most of the Taliban just simply went back to their villages, because that's where they came from. It's very diffuse in terms of its politics. In one province, you'll have Taliban will be building schools. In another province, they'll be throwing acid in the faces of young schoolgirls. There's a big split between the nationalist wing of the Taliban and the Islamicist wing of the Taliban. And then you have the situation in Pakistan. And, of course, the reason why you have this war going on in Pakistan is because of the surge back in 2005 in Afghanistan. What it did was it not only didn't knock out the Taliban, it spread it into Pakistan. There's virtually no possibility that the Pakistan Taliban are going to take over Pakistan. And they're up against the sixth largest army in the world, 700,000 regular soldiers and 550,000 reserves. The idea that the Taliban is going to knock off the Pakistani army is really preposterous. What concerns me about it is, why all the talk about it? And at the back of my mind, I'm thinking, gee, someone is maybe giving a message to the Pakistani military that overthrowing the civilian government may not be a bad idea. It will not be in disfavor in Washington. And that concerns me very much.
Tell us a little bit about what the Taliban have put out there for possible points of negotiations.
Well, late last winter, the Taliban put out a seven-point peace proposal from the wing that's run by Mullah Omar, and who basically is the kind of unifying force in the Taliban. It's a reasonable proposal. Previously, the Taliban had always demanded that the U.S. and NATO had to withdraw, all foreign troops had to be withdrawn before they would talk. Now they've stepped back from that position, and what they've asked for is a timetable, which is really no different than Iraq. They've called for a consensus government. They've called for a constitutional convention to rewrite the Constitution, because they didn't have any part in writing the Constitution. They've called for amnesty. And they have called for integrating the Taliban military forces into the Afghan National Army. That's not an unreasonable proposal. I mean, it's certainly one that I think people could, you know, you could begin negotiations on that. I think if you try to take this position that says, look, we're going to talk to the good Taliban, we're not going to talk to the bad Taliban, you can't do that. I mean, if you're going to negotiate, you can negotiate with the people that you're fighting. The people you agree with, what do you negotiate about? Where you eat dinner? That's not a reasonable approach. You have to say, you have to sit down and respond to this seven-point peace proposal, and Saudi Arabia brought it to Washington. So it's not something that's off the wall. Several Afghan parliamentarians have endorsed it. I think the first thing that the Obama administration ought to do is to take a look at that peace proposal, sit down, call the parties into talks, and start talking. Any military escalation here could threaten to harden both sides on this, and this war has gone on 30 years. Boy, these poor Afghans do not need this war, and neither do the Pakistanis.
That was Khan Hallinan, an analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus. Read his articles online at fpif.org or at counterpunch.org. The state of Massachusetts was the pioneer in same-sex marriages when the state Supreme Court sanctioned them in 2003. California followed in the spring of 2008, but that state's voters reversed the court ruling at the polls last November. Meanwhile, Connecticut's Supreme Court ruled in October of last year that same-sex couples have the right to marry. Attorneys and organizers from the Boston-based legal firm Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD, were instrumental in both the Massachusetts and Connecticut victories. They developed a strategy they call 6x12, meaning they hope to have same-sex marriage in all six New England states by 2012. They picked that date because the current governor of Rhode Island is a staunch gay marriage opponent and will be leaving office then, and they say Rhode Island legislators have been less supportive than their counterparts in other states. In late April, the Iowa Supreme Court legalized gay marriage in that state, and within a few weeks, the legislatures of Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire approved same-sex marriage. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Carissa Cunningham, Public Affairs Director with GLAAD, who assesses the recent wave of victories for gay marriage and the challenges that still lie ahead.
There have been two really extraordinary legislative dramas in Vermont where Governor Douglas vetoed it, and this is what, to me, makes Beth Robinson and Vermont Freedom to Marry such heroes. They organized enough legislative votes to override the veto, and it was a real cliffhanger. And then in Maine, the legislative support was very strong, but the drama was around whether Governor Baldacci would sign it or not, and he did, and he became the first governor to sign an affirmative piece of marriage legislation that actually made it the law of the land in the state. He had to reverse himself, which is a very hard thing for a politician to do. He's one of those people who has said in the past that marriage is between one man and one woman. And in his signing statement, he talked about how he has come to see this as an issue of fairness and equality, which is fabulous and very, very courageous of him.
Well, what is the status of the marriage bill now in New Hampshire?
The marriage bill in New Hampshire has passed through the House and the Senate and has passed with fairly small margins, and it needs to go through some final passages through the Secretary of State's office and signing by a couple of legislative leaders before it lands on Governor Lynch's desk. It's not there yet. Once it's on his desk, he has 5 days to sign it, veto it, or not do anything. And if he doesn't do anything, it becomes law.
What's his position? Has he stated pro or con?
He has said that he's listening. And in the past, he has not been a supporter of marriage equality. But we take it as a hopeful sign that he says at this point he's listening. And the last public statement he made last week was that he wasn't counting the number of phone calls and emails that were coming into his office, but that he was committed to making the best decision for New Hampshire. And I'm choosing to be optimistic about what that means.
And what about Vermont and Maine? Can same-sex couples get married there now?
Vermont will go into effect September 1. And Vermont is free and clear. There are no more potential challenges to that. Maine, the opponents of marriage equality have filed their intention to gather signatures for a petition, and Maine is called a people's veto, where they can put any law that has been passed onto a ballot for voters to vote directly on. So if they are able to gather their signatures, that will be on the ballot in either November or June. And unfortunately, once they file their intention with the Secretary of State, a newly passed law is suspended. So this law is not going to go into effect anytime soon. We don't know when people are going to be able to get married in Maine.
Carissa Cunningham, of course, last year, the California Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples could marry there, but then 5 months later, the state's voters reversed that decision. Do you see a connection between the repeal last November of marriage equality in California and this flurry of laws and court rulings in favor of same-sex marriage elsewhere in the country?
I think that the repeal in California was both shocking and energizing to people who realized that the momentum isn't just all going to go forward without people working on it. So I think it did mobilize people here quite a bit. And I think that energy will continue in Maine, where we have a historic victory there with a governor signing the bill. And there are people who are very, very dedicated to protecting that victory, including the legislators who worked very hard on it. So even though it may well be on the ballot, we feel very confident about continuing the conversation with the people of Maine and with the fair-mindedness of the voters there.
It seems like all these governors have names that are either Italian or Irish, and I wonder how many of them are Catholic. Of course, the Catholic Church has been actively opposed to gay marriage.
Governor Baldacci in Maine is Catholic, and, you know, he talked about that. I don't know about Governor Lynch. Governor Carcieri in Rhode Island is Catholic. One of the really powerful things I thought in Maine was at the public hearing, the bishop came and spoke against the bill. But on our side, there were a number of older Catholic ladies who said, this just isn't right, and the bishop doesn't speak for me, and this is not a church issue. This is a civil issue. And some of these women were just independent thinkers, and some of them were the mothers of adult gay children, but they all stood up and said that there's a diversity of opinion among lay Catholics, and that politicians shouldn't hide behind the idea that their Catholic constituents aren't going to support them on equality, because many of them will support them on equality.
That was Carissa Cunningham of Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders. Contact GLAAD by calling area code 617-426-1350 or visit their website at glaad.org. Barack Obama is conducting meetings with health insurance executives, and Congress is holding hearings in order to fulfill the president's campaign pledge to pass legislation that will reform the U.S. health care system, where more than 47 million Americans live without any health insurance coverage. But there is growing frustration among advocates of single-payer health insurance, as both the president and Congress have attempted to exclude the option of government-run health coverage from being included in the national debate. Two recent protests on Capitol Hill by single-payer healthcare activists, including doctors and nurses, has resulted thus far in 13 arrests. On May 12th, two doctors, two nurses, and one patient activist were charged with disruption of Congress by Capitol Police when the five vocally demanded that Congress pass a single-payer system during a Senate Finance Committee health care reform roundtable. Dominating the Senate proceedings were experts with ties to the for-profit private health insurance industry. The first protest of this type occurred on May 5th before the same Senate committee, when eight protesters rose out of their seats in the hearing room and asked why single-payer advocates were being prevented from participating in the panel. Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, has previously stated that the single-payer option is off the table in the current health care reform debate. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with one of those arrested on May 5th, Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-chair of the Maryland chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, a national organization with 16,000 physician members. She explains why single-payer activists find it necessary to resort to direct action in order to draw attention to the single-payer health care model used by the majority of industrialized nations around the world.
It was a second in a series of three public roundtable discussions that the Senate Finance Committee is holding on health care reform. And in the week leading up to that roundtable, we knew who had been invited to speak, and it was primarily those who represent health insurance industry and big business and the ones who support their agenda. So we had asked if they would include a single-payer advocate at the roundtable, and in addition, we actually did a phone-in campaign and a fax campaign that sent thousands of faxes and phone calls to the offices with the same request, but they refused to invite one single-payer advocate to speak at the roundtable. So we felt like we really didn't have a choice if we wanted our voice to be heard. So we went down there, eight of us. We're all single-payer advocates. We're all knowledgeable about single-payer. And one by one, we asked to have a seat at the table, and one by one, we were arrested and taken out of the committee room.
Why is it that this country doesn't seem to want to even address the possibility of putting in on the table the approach most of the rest of the industrialized nations of the world take to healthcare, meaning a government single-payer system? Why do you think that is so dangerous here in this country that you have to get arrested to say your piece?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a huge disconnect because we know in many independent polls that the public wants a national health program like the other industrialized nations have. They want a single-payer program, and so do healthcare providers. And we really hoped with the election of President Obama that we would see a change in the way Washington politics occur. So we've been meeting with members of Congress for months now, talking to them, just asking to be included. But what it comes down to is on the policy, if you compared a national health program based on single-payer financing to any of the reforms that they're considering right now, single-payer would win. It saves money. It includes everybody. It improves health outcomes. It allows doctors and patients to make medical decisions instead of insurance companies. But we know how much money, you know, the pharmaceutical and health insurance industries are the highest campaign donors that there are.
I've heard about some anti-national health care ads that are airing or being prepared to run around the country. And it plays on people's fear of a government bureaucracy denying them treatment for this or that disease, or rationing, or waiting, you know, endlessly for essential treatment or medical care. Do you think the American people will be vulnerable to this campaign of fear that somehow government health care insurance would equal disaster in their personal lives?
You know, I hope that they aren't. I mean, I hope that people will, you know, educate themselves this time, because really, you know, it's completely the opposite. If you look at the evidence, the public programs do much better in terms of, you know, when you have a public health facility and a private, the public health facility actually does better in terms of outcomes and provides care for a lower cost. And we know that we have rationing in this country already. If we just ration based on ability to pay, there's no real public debate about what we want to do as a health, as a country when it comes to health. It's just all about whether you can afford it or not. So I hope that people will, you know, talk to each other and really, you know, learn about this issue.
What's going on in the House? You mentioned that there's been more success in getting this, the option of single payer raised in the House of Representatives than in the U.S. Senate. John Conyers has Medicare for All bill, I think is the nickname of it.
Right.
Maybe you could explain a little bit about that bill and where it's headed right now and the role of the public in trying to get a fair hearing for that legislation.
So the bill is H.R. 676, Expanded and Improved Medicare for All, and Congressman Conyers and Congressman Dennis Kucinich are the lead sponsors for that. But we have 75 co-sponsors for that right now. And what it would do is it would create a national health system that every single person living in the United States would receive a health card, and that would cover all medically necessary care, including preventative care and mental health, dental, vision, prescription drugs, long-term. And you would be given a card, and you have complete choice of where you want to go, which doctor, which hospital. You know, if you're traveling in another state and you have a, you know, need to see a doctor, you use your card and you can be seen there. There's no concern about being in or out of network. I just wanted to mention, because people always say, well, how can we afford to do that, is that multiple studies have shown that if we enact this type of a system, it actually saves money for the country while providing health care to everybody. But what we're trying to do in the House is we really need to get another 95 co-sponsors. If we can get about 170 co-sponsors, then we can start moving that bill, you know, through the process. So we're asking people to find out if their Congress member has co-sponsored H.R. 676. And if they haven't, then to meet with them and ask them to co-sponsor or develop letter-writing campaigns or call-in campaigns or petitions or anything that you can do to convince your Congress member to support this bill.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-chair of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at pnhp.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.